This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 9th of September, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister has been in Ireland trying to break the Brexit logjam. Early results suggest big losses for Vladimir Putin's party in Moscow city elections. Nearly all British Airways flights have been grounded as pilots begin a two-day walkout, the worst industrial action the airline has faced in its history. Also in this podcast, the cleanup from Hurricane Dorian is underway. 43 people are confirmed dead, but this figure is expected to rise.
I had to leave because it ain't nothing there. Nothing at all. Everything just gone.
And a world free of malaria? A major report suggests it could happen by 2050. Throughout the political carnage the Conservative Party in Britain has been inflicting on itself in recent days, the sackings, resignations and defections, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has insisted that whilst he's prepared to leave the EU without a deal on October the 31st, he is still trying to broker one. To underline that point, he's been in Dublin today talking with his Irish counterpart, Leo Varadkar, about ways of dealing with the main sticking point, preventing a deal, the Northern Ireland backstop. It's an insurance policy in UK-EU Brexit negotiations meant to make sure that the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland remains open in the future. The border is a matter of great political, security and diplomatic sensitivity in Ireland, a point Mr. Varadkar reiterated at a press conference with Mr. Johnson.
Avoiding return to a hard border on this island and protecting our place in the single market are the Irish government's priorities in all circumstances. We must protect the peace and also the burgeoning all-island economy. And that's why for us the backstop continues to be a critical component of the withdrawal agreement, unless and until alternatives are found. But we are open to alternatives, but they must be realistic ones, legally binding and workable, and we haven't received such proposals to date.
Mr. Johnson responded.
I acknowledge the complexities involved and the symbolism and the sensitivities evoked by the very concept of a border. But strip away the politics, and at the core of each problem, you find practical issues that can be resolved with sufficient energy and a spirit of compromise.
Rob Watson is our London correspondent.
I thought this was just one of the most extraordinary news conferences I'd ever seen. So first, in terms of the optics, if you think about the history of Britain and Ireland, I mean, by and large, you know, Ireland has obviously been the junior partner in terms of demographic size, politics, size of its economy, and the UK very much the senior partner. But, I mean, they almost looked as though Leo Varadkar was the sort of the cross schoolmaster, head teacher, dealing with a sort of naughty pupil, because leading on to the politics of it all, I mean, it seemed to me that Mr. Varadkar just utterly trashed Boris Johnson's entire Brexit policy and sort of cast doubts on his truthfulness, because he basically said no deal would be hopeless, you know, that the idea of some kind of clean Brexit where Britain walks away from the EU and never discusses it again was fantasy. A trade deal with the United States would take years. And also, perhaps most fundamentally, Mr. Varadkar kind of questioned all this stuff about whether Mr. Johnson really did have any proposals to deal with the border issue in Ireland, or indeed to get a deal more generally with the European Union.
So things not necessarily going well for Mr. Johnson over in Ireland. Where you are at Westminster, we're looking ahead to another important vote, aren't we?
Yes, and Mr. Johnson seems to be in a fix here too. We know Parliament is about to be suspended, but before that, this law should be signed off on by the Queen that would make a no-deal Brexit illegal on the 31st of October. And at the same time, the Parliament is also expected to vote against Mr. Johnson's desire for a sort of, you know, let's have a scrap about what happens with Brexit on October the 15th. So Mr. Johnson would seem to be in a bind if that's what happens. What is he going to do? And I guess very briefly, the options are to just kind of accept all of this and that have an election after Brexit has been delayed, blame it all on Parliament. I suppose he could resign. He could try and get a deal with the European Union. And I suppose sort of last of all is hope for the best.
Rob Watson. To Russia now, where initial results in local elections show that the country's governing party, United Russia, that was set up to support President Putin, has suffered major falls in support. It lost nearly a third of the seats it controlled in Moscow's parliament, but it has managed to cling on to its majority there. Turnout, though, was very low. Sarah Rainsford reports from Moscow.
The mayor of Moscow took to Twitter to call these elections the most emotional and genuinely competitive in recent history. Sergei Sobyanin welcomed winning candidates from the Communist Party and even four liberals to their seats in the city's parliament. What he didn't mention was the resounding defeat this vote marks for the governing party, United Russia, a brand that's become so toxic lately that all its members ran in Moscow as independents. They were punished at the polls, though, in any case. The opposition politician Alexei Navalny promoted a strategy of smart voting after his own allies were all barred from running in this election, sparking mass protests. So Mr. Navalny's team outed undercover United Russia candidates and campaigned for those best placed to defeat them. He hailed the result as a triumph, as even the head of United Russia's Moscow branch lost his seat. State media are mostly presenting this as a win for the governing party in any case. But the Kremlin will certainly be studying the real picture and what it says about the public mood here, including anger over the mass arrest of largely peaceful opposition protesters this summer.
Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. British Airways has cancelled most of its flights today. Pilots are on strike after rejecting an 11.5% pay rise. Some mates say that sounds like a big pay rise, so why haven't the pilots accepted it? My colleague Dan Damon asked Alistair Rosenshein, a former BA pilot who's now an aviation consultant.
Well, on the face of it, it does sound like quite a lot, and I'm sure they'd be very happy with that. However, that's a three-year pay deal, and so the pay on offer this year is 4%. It's 3.5% next year and 3% the third year. This doesn't really acknowledge the fact that pilots took a fairly large pay cut in previous years when the airline wasn't doing so well, and they did this voluntarily. In a way, they feel a little bit hard done by that. They would now like to see a profit share. That's the same as the directors of the company get. And the airline standing firm doesn't want to do that.
The cost to British Airways of a continued strike is probably higher, actually, than they would be paying out if they agreed to what the pilots want. Is that correct?
You're right. A strike's probably costing between £40 and £50 million per day. And there are 3 days of strikes planned, two at the moment and then one on the 27th of September. And it is said that if they met the union's demands, if you like, it would be closer to £5 million a year. Nonetheless, it could be that Alex Cruz, the chap in charge of British Airways, is concerned that this may set a precedent for other staff groups. And then that would become an issue and become very expensive.
How much difference has the growth of the low-cost airlines made to the kind of profitability of a company like British Airways and what pilots can expect to earn?
As it happens, the low-cost carriers do actually pay quite reasonable salaries to their pilots. The other thing is that the main aspect of the low-cost carriers is actually to cause changes to the full-fare airlines, such as British Airways, where they've downgraded their services and you now have to pay for sandwiches on board instead of free food. And it has made a difference. But in terms of reducing pay because of the low-cost carriers, no, it doesn't really have that effect.
So how do you see this being resolved then?
Round a table, like all these things are resolved, coming face to face and agreeing some sort of compromise. And I'm sure they will have a compromise and they will agree it and everything will be back to normal in the end. But the airline is penalising the pilots at the moment by saying that anyone who goes on strike will suffer a 3-year cancellation of their staff travel rights. So that then becomes part of the negotiation to get that reinstated. That will particularly hardly impact on those pilots who commute by air to their base. Wherever it is they're flying from, be it Gatwick, Heathrow or any of the other airports around the country. And so that would have to be resolved fairly quickly.
You mean they'd have to pay for the flight to get them to work?
That's right, yes, as opposed to getting a 90% discount on the flight. They pay a normal aircraft duty. You know, it's a really nice perk and the pilots like that perk, as do all the other airline staff. But to have the penalty imposed for 3 years is clearly not going to improve goodwill.
That was Alistair Rosenshein. 500,000 people die every year from malaria, and many of those are children under the age of 5. But a new report by global health experts say that the world could be completely free from the disease by 2050. There's a caveat, though. Eradication will only happen if billions more dollars are invested. One of the scientists who helped write the report is Dr. Fred Binker from the University of Health and Allied Sciences in Ghana. He says that rural communities must have better access to healthcare.
Those who need the treatment most are unable to get it. But we now have effective treatments that once diarrhea is diagnosed, we are able to treat people. In most parts of the developing world, especially where malaria is endemic, the health systems are not very efficient, so they don't reach many people. You also need to provide prevention methods. But in all of this, you also need to have the funding that is required to do this.
I've been speaking to our health and science correspondent, James Gallagher, and I asked him why people who'd written the report were feeling so optimistic.
So if you go since the year 2000, then we've seen the number of countries with malaria fall by a fifth. So 106 had malaria at the turn of the millennium. It's now only 86. The number of cases has fallen by more than a third. So the world is making huge progress against malaria at the moment. If we did nothing more than we're doing at the moment, the expectation is that by 2050, there would still be malaria in the world, but far less than there is now. And it would be a band across Central Africa. Now, this report was going, how can we do even better than that? And their conclusion was that for an extra $2 billion a year, then actually all malaria could be eradicated by 2050.
And what kind of research and development are we talking about? We're talking about gene technology, aren't we?
You're right. There's this technology that people are getting quite excited but also quite nervous about called gene drives. Now, what it does is it's a way of disregarding the normal rules of inheritance. So, you know, I've got two kids and my genes have a 50-50 chance of reaching each of those children. With gene drives, you can guarantee that those genetic instructions are passed on to every single one of your descendants. So in lab experiments, scientists have been able to completely collapse large mosquito populations by basically spreading an infertility gene throughout an entire population of mosquitoes so that suddenly there are no mosquitoes anymore. Maybe you could give the mosquitoes resistance to the malaria parasite itself, so suddenly you could make every mosquito resistant to malaria. So these are the ideas that are being developed, and they're being described in this report as a potentially game-changing technology.
And what's your impression? Is there the focus that there needs to be on malaria when there are other diseases that are perhaps more high profile at the moment, like Ebola?
The thing about malaria is that malaria is there all the time, killing mostly children under five every single day of the year. Now, lots of people want to get it done, but we're talking about huge amounts of money. It's already more than $4 billion being spent a year. You've got to come up with another two in order to get to this 2050 goal. And the real challenge will be getting enough people on board with that.
James Gallagher. Still to come on this podcast, there are calls for stricter sanctions on cyberbullying after a pop star speaks out.
There were so many messages, nasty ones, but the one that was at the top was from like a random man. And yeah, he just was like saying how disgusting I am and that I don't deserve to be in the girl band and that I deserve to die.
And tensions in Zimbabwe over where Robert Mugabe should be buried. The authorities in the Bahamas have defended their handling of the devastating hurricane that hit the island last week following fierce criticism. The health minister, Duane Sands, denied that there had been any cover-up of the number of deaths. He said the priority was not body counts, but finding missing people and providing food, water and comfort to the injured. These survivors of the storm who arrived in Nassau spoke about their experiences.
I lost a lot of friends. I lost a lot of friends' homes. God spared my life. I had four sheets of my plywood come up my house. I'm so thankful. But very lucky around. Friends.
Met plenty of people dead. Plenty of people. Maybe 400 people dead.
I had to leave because it ain't nothing there. Nothing at all. Everything just gone. Car, house, dog, gone. This is it.
Well, at the moment, at least 43 people are confirmed dead, but that figure is expected to rise sharply. The head of the US Agency for International Development has likened the devastation inflicted on the Bahamas by Hurricane Dorian to that of a nuclear bomb. Mark Green was speaking after flying over Grand Bahama and the Abaco Islands, where the storm made landfall a week ago.
What I was struck by was the focused nature of the devastation. So there are parts of Abaco and the Bahamas that don't show a great deal of damage, and then there are clusters and communities that were devastated, almost as though nuclear bombs were dropped on them. That's how great the suffering is and the devastation is. There's a long road ahead, but we're going to work closely with the Prime Minister and his government to make sure that we help provide immediate relief for the important weeks and months ahead in recovery.
Carl Smith is the spokesperson for the National Emergency Management Agency of the Bahamas. He gave details of the rescue operation.
The evacuation plan is to provide temporary housing in Abaco to assist those persons who wish to stay on the island. NEMA and its partners have not commenced any mass-scale debris cleaning in Abaco. Search and recovery is still being conducted, particularly in Marsh Harbor, where deceased bodies are discovered. They're being handled in the most respectful manner.
Mr. Smith also responded to criticism that the response had been slow.
I am satisfied that NEMA, with its partners, is doing everything it can to move as effectively and as efficiently as it can, given the circumstances. We are dealing with a disaster. We have coming on board additional partners with expertise, and I've alluded to some of them, so you will see an improvement in the situation as we move forward.
My colleague Dan Damon spoke to Matthew Cochran, the spokesperson for the International Federation of the Red Cross, about the humanitarian efforts.
The priorities have really crystallised around providing shelter to people. A lot of people have lost their homes, so they'll need emergency shelter assistance in the short term and then longer term help to rebuild their homes. And we're still seeing major needs around providing clean water, food and basic relief supplies. Abaco and Grand Bahama are both still without electricity. I think on Abaco, most of the wells were flooded in the initial storm and storm surge. So clean water and sanitation are both major priorities.
How will the aid be got to those who need it?
It's certainly not easy at this stage. We're talking about an impact area that's spread out over a number of different islands. So simply getting from one point to another is complex. It involves boats and planes and helicopters. A lot of people, though, have evacuated, particularly from Abaco, and are now in and around Nassau. It's going to be comparatively easier to provide them with assistance. Yeah, the access is complex at the moment. I think speaking to colleagues yesterday, there is a bit of a sense of frustration about how difficult it's proving to be. But the pipeline's beginning to open up. We've had three flights now land full of relief supplies. We have a boat that, if it didn't arrive late yesterday, then it's certainly going to arrive today. So the relief supplies are beginning to come in, and I think there's some predictability and to the relief effort as it comes to speed.
One of the things revealed by the overflights was the number of people whose lives have been lost and whose bodies are still there. That represents a real health risk.
Primarily, I think it represents a real trauma risk for the families who've lost their loved ones. Dead bodies don't in and of themselves pose a major health risk unless the person has died from something that's very infectious. Obviously, it's quite disturbing for bodies to be out to see them, but as I said, also for family members. So it's a priority to recover those for the authorities and to recover those in a way that allows for people who've died to be identified, and so their families can mourn them and bury them and begin to rebuild and move on with their lives. It's an incredibly important part of any humanitarian response.
That was Matthew Cochran. It's been 3 days since the death of Zimbabwe's former president, Robert Mugabe, and the country's government has confirmed that his funeral will take place over 2 days this coming weekend. Mr. Mugabe died in a hospital in Singapore, and his remains are due to fly back to Zimbabwe on Wednesday. But there have been disagreements between his family and the government over where he should be buried. Our correspondent Shingai Nyoka reports from Mr. Mugabe's hometown, Jimba.
I meet Josephine Jaricha and Cecilia Mpariwa herding cattle in the fields across from Robert Mugabe's childhood home.
They're not just relatives and neighbours of Mugabe, they're his fiercest defenders. He visited his rural home regularly before he was deposed. supplied food and clothes for his entire village, and attended all the funerals he could. But after the coup, they hardly saw him here, and they are bitter about the way he was deposed.
Zimbabwe is so chaotic now, and the politics is so toxic. It's about trading insults and denigrating each other.
Mugabe paved the way for every black child to get an education, but the younger generation now disparage him. Every success this country has achieved is because of Mugabe.
I ask them about the violence meted out on his opponents and critics. They dismiss it as untrue. The man they knew was always kind and compassionate. As I leave them, they drive their cows past Mugabe's homestead. In one of the rooms inside the house, village elders and clan chiefs are deciding where the statesman should be buried. These negotiations include the government, but it seems a row is brewing between the family and the state over his burial site. And while his nephew Leo Mugabe denies any disagreement, he admits his uncle died a bitter man.
You can imagine people that you trusted are the same people that turn against you. You know, it's very bitter and it dented his legacy. We were taught to forgive. But you see, you want to forgive somebody who come to you and say, I'm sorry I did this. But if one doesn't say that, how do you forgive? You can just forget.
We would discuss issues pertaining to the...
And the man who's been preaching forgiveness is Father Fidelis Mukonori. He played a key role in the negotiations between the coup plotters and Mugabe, a friend of over 40 years and the Mugabe family priest. He says he wishes he'd asked his friend if he did indeed feel betrayed.
I feel heavy inside because you can only have one founding father for a nation, and he's gone.
Mr. Mugabe never shied away from controversy. And while his remains are expected in the country this week, heads of state are invited to a public ceremony, but not to the interment. If he is buried in his rural home, it will be his final snub to the comrades he believed betrayed him.
That was Shingai Nyoka reporting. For decades, the Sudanese government has been heavily criticised for discriminating against non-Muslims. Now the new civilian government has sent out a strong signal that it intends to do things differently. It invited a small community of Sudanese Jews living in exile to return home. There used to be up to 1,000 Jews in the country, but they almost all left Sudan because of tensions following the creation of Israel. So what do they make of the invitation? My colleague James Copnell asked Daisy Aboudi, founder of the website Tales of Jewish Sudan.
I think it's a really great first step. Until meaningful diplomatic relations with Israel are established and are secure, I think it's going to just remain a really welcome, positive first gesture.
It is, though, a pretty unusual, well, unheard of gesture in the recent history of Sudan.
It is. I think it's happened in other MENA countries, so it's not completely unheard of.
Middle East and North Africa, yeah.
Middle East and North Africa countries. It's a very positive first step.
Tell us a little bit about the Sudanese Jewish community, much smaller, say, than the community in Morocco or somewhere like that. Where do they come from? Were they part of the wave of traders and business people who came in the late 19th, early 20th centuries?
They were. There was a small Jewish community in Sudan before that, and they had been forcibly converted to Islam. When the Anglo-Egyptian condominium took over the country, they were allowed to convert back to Judaism, and some of them chose to do that. The rest of the community came from about 1901, and the reason it was so interesting and unique is because it's a mixture of Jews from all over the Middle East. So it became a real melting pot for all of those Jewish cultures, which is quite unusual. And they also adopted the culture and the traditions of Sudan itself.
When you say adopted traditions, can you give us an example?
For example, the food culture adopted parts of Sudanese cooking that they wouldn't have known before. Little things like rhymes, nursery rhymes, just small bits of culture that you just pick up by living in a country.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Tales of Jewish Sudan website. You've got a recipe section, malahia and things like that. Sudanese classics are on there. Why then do people leave?
The changing political situation is really why people left. It gradually became a much more hostile environment to live in. The media started to change. There were a few accusations, such as espionage and all completely false. And
in this is post-Sudanese independence in 56.
Post-Sudanese independence in 1956. And then in 1967, there was a six-day war with Israel. All the young Jewish men who were left in Sudan were arrested without charge, detained for a few days until the war was over and they were released. And that was really the final point when people thought, okay, now anyone who was left thought, really, we have to leave. And there were just a very, very small number of Jews who remained until 1973 when they also left.
In your experience talking to members of that community, was it an exile community that very much still talked about the good old days, maybe some of the bad old days back in Sudan, or was there a sort of clean break?
No, I think they do. I mean, I've interviewed about over 70 people, Jewish people who used to live in Sudan, and they're such fantastic characters and personalities, and they talk about this cosmopolitan lifestyle with, you know, their own clubs, and they used to play sports against the other communities, and it was a very much a community-based lifestyle and a very friendly lifestyle as well, until things did start to change, obviously.
That was Daisy Aboudi speaking to my colleague James Copnell. There are calls in Britain for tougher measures to be introduced to deal with cyberbullying. That's after a young female pop singer revealed that trolls drove her to try to take her own life. Jessie Nelson from the band Little Mix says that she was deluged with cruel comments for her weight and appearance after winning a TV talent contest. Chichi Izundu reports.
The winner of the X Factor 2011 is...
It should have been a moment of joy.
Little Mix!
But after the cameras had stopped rolling and the celebration should have started, Jessie Nelson was reading messages online.
There were so many messages, nasty ones, but the one that was at the top was from like a random man. And yeah, he just was like saying how disgusting I am and that I don't deserve to be in the girl band and that I deserve to die.
How do you feel when you post on Instagram?
Jessie says she still gets abuse on social media, but 4 years ago, the comments affected her so much she started missing work, fell into a depression, and then attempted suicide.
Now when I look back on that, I'm like, I can't believe I ever like did that. But when you're in that state of mind, you don't think about like what you're going to leave behind or like the people that you're going to have an effect on. You just want to take that pain away. That's all you care about.
But cyberbullying doesn't just happen to those in the public eye. A report from the media watchdog Ofcom in 2018 found one in five 12 to 15 year olds had experienced some sort of online bullying. Jessie is now off some social media. She wants stronger consequences for those who send abuse, but hopes her candid admission about her suicide attempt will show the harm cyberbullying can cause.
That was Chichi Izundu reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.
Hello. Where has your life taken you?
It's kind of an adventure.
Did you expect to end up where you are now?
I really believe that I'm making some change.
The documentary podcast from the BBC World Service takes you to surprising and unexpected places.
People are afraid to use the road
at night. Yeah.
And that's exactly what happened to the people in our new series of shows.
That's the road we're walking back on.
Yeah.
My name's Asif Kapadia, and I'm the presenter of Detours, produced in collaboration with Sundance Institute. We'll meet Greeks sending dead relatives over the mountains to Bulgaria.
I ask sometimes the body, what kind of music do you like?
Wild elephants forced off their feeding paths in Assam, India.
How can one relax when there's an elephant just outside your homestead?
People on the move from Africa seeking better lives in the USA.
How many people do you share a tent with?
10 people. Yeah, 10 people are sharing the tent, yeah.
A young Rohingya man stuck on an island in the Pacific.
Have I committed any crime? No. I'm just trying to save my life.
And a Macedonian medical student writing fake news for a living.
We know what's wrong, but sometimes in our country, the wrong is the only way to survive.
That's Detours on the documentary podcast from the BBC World Service.
We're passing by life, you know. We're here now and then we're not.
Just search for The Documentary wherever you get your podcasts.